You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And, the White House threatened me. Oh, wait a minute. That wasn't me. They invited me over to the White House. What's that? Oh, yeah, I did go. Okay. Well, but Lanny Davis, you know, I mean, he wanted to. Okay. Yeah. All right. Oh, Mr. Shane is informing me that Mr. Woodward's comments were badly taken out of context by Mr. Woodward. This is nuts. Have you seen this? Anyway, we'll get into this a little later on. This is just hysterical. Papatoni is going to be with us in our second hour. The Dow just crossed 14,000. I'm wondering, is it time to be buying VXX and bail out of everything else? But that's a whole other conversation. Lance Roberts is on the line with us. He's with the chief economist with Street Talk Advisors, streettalklive.com. And apparently a spokesperson for right-wing or Republican political positions with regard to this, Lance?
Well, I'm sorry, say that again?
Well, my understanding is you're taking the position that the Republicans are just fine on this and that there ain't no big deal with this sequester. Do I have that right?
Well, no, we've got to put this back into context. I'm an economist and a financial money manager. So, you know, my point about this is that, first of all, you know, we have to start to recognize that we have a spending and a debt issue. I mean,
why?
When we talk about economic growth.
Wait a minute. We don't have a spending or a debt issue. We're able to borrow money at less than 2%, which means that nobody thinks we have a debt issue. And we can, you know, we're the sovereign issuer of the currency. We can spend a hell of a lot more than we are now. We did after World War II. We had 127% debt to GDP ratio after World War II. And how did Truman and Republican Eisenhower get us out of that terrible debt problem? They borrowed more money and spent it.
Not exactly true, but we can talk about history.
It is. It's the national highway system, the 50% of the cost of every new hospital in America throughout the 1950s.
The way we got out of, look, in 1929, we were peaking out at roughly about 130% of debt to GDP. By the end of World War II, as we came out of World War II and came back across the recovery, we had reduced that debt to 50% of debt to GDP. That was done through expansion of the workforce by producing the goods and services needed to fight the battles overseas.
Right. In other words, government spending. World War II was the largest government spending program of the 20th century. So government spending got us out of the Great Depression.
Look what happened to the Americans at that point. But let's fast forward to today. We just got GDP out this morning, flat for the last quarter.
Right.
So look, we're spending money like crazy.
No, we're not.
We're spending money, $85 billion a month buying debt to try to keep interest rates suppressed.
No, we're not.
The average American hasn't seen wage growth in the last 5 years.
The average American hasn't seen wage growth since Ronald Reagan became president and declared war on labor. Wages have been flat since 1980.
Actually, wages have declined on an inflation-adjusted basis since 1980.
You're absolutely right. And productivity has increased, and where did all the profit from that increased productivity go? It went to the CEOs and to the stockholders.
Look, the consumer debt has risen by to 190% of debt to disposable income.
Right, because we're being screwed by the CEO class.
Not really.
Well, wait a minute. Their income has gone up. Well over 500% since Reagan's presidency, and the income of the average working person, and by the way, so has productivity, and the income, I'm sorry, was it 127%? I got my percents wrong, but anyhow, it's gone up substantially, which I'm sure agree with. The income of average working people hasn't. Productivity and income of working people from the George Washington administration to the Ronald Reagan administration tracked each other. And
absolutely.
With the Reagan administration, income of working people flattened out, and productivity continued to go up, and the profit from that went to the CEOs and the stockholders. The working people got screwed.
Right. So I'm agreeing with you on this. And what I'm trying to tell you is that a big function of this has been the increase in debt and the usage of debt and leverage within the system, which has been capitalized on by corporations who have taken advantage of tax laws and profitability structures, et cetera, to drive down profitability, increase productivity, to lower wage growth. So the reason you don't get economic growth and the reason you have an income disparity is because of the structure of debt within the country today. It's simple economics.
In part, I don't disagree with that, Lance. In fact,
prosperity.
We have, you know, we have a national public sector debt of around $15 trillion. We have a private sector debt of $38
trillion. But go ahead.
We have a private sector debt of $38 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
We have a trade deficit every year of $800 billion. It's a total debt since Reagan of around $9 trillion. Why is nobody talking about that?
Well, and now don't forget about your $50 trillion unfunded liability in Medicare and Social Security.
Which may or may not exist. According to the Medicare actuaries, there is no unfunded liability because funds are guaranteed to be paid out of the general fund.
Well,
so
Medicare
matter.
Medicare actuaries are great. They're a government-paid organization, which is wonderful.
Well, you're going to quote somebody.
The reality is, look, you've got an aging population that is living longer, and they are a drag on the usage of Medicare and Social Security.
That's nonsense.
It's a simple function of math. The longer they live, the more they take out of the system.
That's nonsense.
In the 1930s, you had 16 payers going into the system. Today, you have two for every
No, that's nonsense. In the 1930s, first of all, lifespan has not increased except for people who are in the top 20% of the income bracket in the United States. Lifespan.
In the 1930s
and in fact, if you take infant mortality out of lifespan, lifespan hasn't increased since 1900. If you simply take out infant mortality, that's the main variable. Used to be that little kids died in the first couple of years, usually from infections before we invented antibiotics. You take infant mortality out. I mean, you know, Jefferson lived until into his 70s and 80s. Madison, Lance.
Life expectancy is one issue, but it's also the number of people that pay into the system versus the number of people that pay out.
And that's why Ronald Reagan said that the boomers.
Completely different issue.
Lance, you do understand that up until 1981, Social Security was paying out with dollars to retired people with dollars that came in from people who were working. And starting in 81, Ronald Reagan said the boomer generation, just the boomer generation, it's going to be the first generation in history, they're going to double pay. Not only are they going to pay for the retirement of their parents, but they're also going to be double taxed and pay for their own retirement. And they created the Social Security Trust Fund, which did not exist before 1981. It has $2.7 trillion in it right now because the boomers double paid on their Social Security, and that fund is supposed to go back down to zero by the time the last boomer dies and the rabbit finishes going through the python. There is no demographic problem. Reagan fixed it.
See, this is the problem, though. You still have a huge number of people that are drawing off the system, and you have less people paying in. It's a dollar.
But we saved $2.7 trillion for this rainy day.
There's no rainy day fund there.
There's $2.7 trillion in the Social Security Trust Fund.
No, there's not. There's no dollar sitting there. It's IOUs.
Do you, Lance? IOUs, wait a minute. You're an economist and you're a trader. Do you ever buy government bonds or sell government bonds?
Hardly ever.
But you know what they are, right?
Money manager. I'll tell you what. You know, because
you do know what they are.
Of course I do.
So you're trying to tell me that they have no intrinsic value. That if I've got a $10,000 T-bill, it has no value because it's just an IOU.
Look, all bonds, regardless of what they are, corporates, municipals, etc., they're all IOUs. They are a promise to pay in the future based
right.
on
and,
money that
and the safest
today.
Bonds on earth
and
are U.S. Treasuries.
Look, basic financial
which is what
here.
Which is what Social Security is invested in.
The value. Now listen, this is really important. You're dependent upon the value of the dollar that you're repaid in terms of regaining your principal.
Sure.
We are lowering the value of the dollar, which means that when I buy a 30-year treasury, when I get that back on an inflation-adjusted basis, I have lost money. That's the point we're trying to bring across.
Assuming that inflation exceeds the interest rate.
The point is simply this. With
Lance, I'm sorry, we're out of time. I really did want to hear your point, but it's a hard clock. We'll be back in 15 minutes. Hang on just a second here.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Lance Roberts, you can check out his writing over at streettalklive.com. Lance, thank you for being with us.
No problem.
Good talking with you. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, you know, respectfully to my previous guest, we don't have a spending problem in the United States. Now, you can argue that we've got weird spending priorities. We spend more on the military than every other country on earth combined. And our schools suck. You know, we're not putting enough money into our schools. Our teachers are not well paid. I mean, you could, you've got $1 trillion in student debt from people trying to go to college, which never used to be. We don't have a national health care system. Every other developed country in the world does. We're slowly developing one, but it's going to make a lot of profit for the health insurance industry. It's going to be very wasteful. It'll be better than what we had. It's a good step in the right direction. And most importantly, in another 4 years, it'll over 3 years, I guess, it'll open the door for Vermont and possibly Montana, definitely Vermont, to run a single-payer system within their state, which I think is going to be, you know, the thing that's going to cause other states to realize, hey, this works. Duh. Robert Solow, S-O-L-O-W, in the New York Times today. Now, this guy, speaking of economists, he's a Nobel-winning, Nobel Prize, Nobel laureate. He won the Nobel Prize. He's an economist emeritus at the in economics, a professor emeritus of economics at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And he wrote an op-ed, you know, that it is entitled "Our Debt, Ourselves," and it's just kind of, you know, going through some of the silliness that is being put out there about the sequester and our debt and all this kind of stuff. And I'll just cut to the chase. The next to the very last sentence, actually the last two sentences are brilliant. In fact, I'll read you the last three sentences, which summarizes what he has to say. He says, in the long run, we need a clear plan to reduce the ratio of publicly held debt to national income. Okay, I agree with that. He said, but for now, the best chance to reinvigorate the economy, spur business investment, and encourage consumer spending is through public borrowing and spending. Instead, we're heading into an ill-advised across-the-board austerity program. Now, here's what I find. In other words, he's saying borrow more money and spend it. Put people to work. Make the government the employer of last resort. With which I absolutely agree. And if you don't want to borrow it, then implement the Buffett rule. Say that a billionaire cannot pay less in income taxes than his or her secretary. It's really simple. You know, just say, you know, whatever loopholes you're using, it's sort of like the alternative minimum tax. You know, the alternative minimum tax is like a loophole avoidance device for the upper middle class. Why not have one for rich people? Oh, that's right. They own Congress. I'd forgotten. At least they own the Republicans in Congress and a few conservatives. But, you know, if you don't want to borrow and spend, then tax and spend. But either way, the federal government needs to be spending more money right now. And instead, they're dialing it back. You know, the sequester, which is going to kick in tomorrow, is going to cut 700,000 jobs in our economy. Now, you know, I'm a business person. I've been in business since I was 16 years old. I've been running my own company since then. I've worked for a few people along the way, but usually I've worked for myself. And I can tell you from real experience in the real world that if you have a business and your biggest customer starts buying less stuff from you, it doesn't make your business more prosperous. But that's the Republican logic, is that the biggest customer in the U.S. economy is the federal government, and therefore we're going to dial back on the federal government's spending, purchasing, and somehow that's magically going to help the economy. If the federal government buys fewer solar installations, buys less asphalt to fix its roads, buys less concrete to build its bridges, buys less steel pipe to fix its water systems. If the federal government starts buying less of this stuff, that's going to be a good thing. It's going to help the economy. It'll put people to work, don't you know? Just think about that for a minute. Isn't that the most stupid thing you've ever heard? And what really boggles my mind is that when you watch the media and you look at these surveys and studies, and I'm talking by the media, I'm from the New York Times to the big networks, to the cable networks, progressive, conservative, I don't care. You listen to all these people, and they're positing it as a binary choice. You can either increase taxes like the Democrats want to do by saying billionaires have to pay the same tax rate as their secretaries, or cut spending like the Republicans want to do, by throwing grandma off the cliff, or a little bit of both. But those are the only two options that are even being discussed. Raise taxes, cut spending. What about option three, which is the one that I've been, you know, the longtime listeners, if you've been listening to this program for years, you know, for 9 years I've been talking about this. Yeah, I was alive when Eisenhower was president. I was born, more or less, when he was running for president. I mean, I wasn't, like, super conscious of Eisenhower when I was 2 years old, but, you know, I do have some recollection of that era, and I know it quite well. He was a good Republican who borrowed a lot of money and spent it to stimulate our economy, and it worked. You put people to work, and that pays down the debt faster than absolutely anything. You try to cut federal spending to pay down your debt, it's going to make your debt worse because you're laying people off, and they're going to move from paying taxes, to consuming taxes. I got to stop drinking coffee before I go on the air. I end up yelling at my guests that they don't know what they're talking about. And anyway, and it attacks me. So why is this third option not being discussed, of increasing spending? Make the government the employer of last resort. You've got, you know, somewhere between 7 and 20 million people out there who would like a full-time, good-paying job. And you've got a government that issues U.S. dollars and could easily hire them. And we can borrow at 1% right now. And when you put them to work, you're going to get a heck of a lot better than 1% return on that investment, because they're going to be paying taxes for years and years. And they're going to be making things and doing things that increase the net wealth of the entire society. This is not rocket science.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So why is it that everybody except the Progressive Caucus in the House of Representatives and Bernie Sanders are missing this? And let me tell you about what the Progressive Caucus did right after the break. One of our callers today is going to receive a free signed copy of my book, Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. Free signed copy of Unequal Protection will be sent using stamps.com. That caller could be you. Welcome back to our program, brought to you by the effort to free America's political prisoner, Karl Rove's political prisoner, Don Siegelman, the former governor of Alabama. You can learn all about it at free-don.com. And tell him we said hi. This is an effort that's really worth doing. free-don.com. I think they have both. In any case, I mentioned the solution to our problems over the short term. You know, obviously over the long term, we have to get our debt to GDP ratio in better shape. But it's not a problem right now. If it was a problem, our interest rates would be high. It's as Dick Cheney famously said. Ronald Reagan taught us that deficits don't matter. Ronald Reagan tripled the national debt. Did it do anything? Actually, it goosed up the economy. You know, we had a crash during Reagan's presidency. This is the worst that we'd had since 1929. Stock market crash and a recession. Worst ever. How did Reagan get us out of it? Borrowed and spent. The problem is that he established a baseline for that where, you know, continuously borrowing and spending. Well, until Bill Clinton came along, and Bill Clinton said, hey, we're prosperous. Now that we're prosperous, let's pay down that debt. Let's start asking the millionaires and billionaires to pay their fair share. Raise the top income tax rate from 36 to 39%. Poof, deficit vanishes. George Bush gets sworn into office, says, we're going to pay down the debt. We got enough surplus here that Bill Clinton left us that we can pay off everything, every penny. Over the next decade, we'll pay off every penny that is available to be paid off. So I guess you could say I'm not an advocate of Reaganomics, because what he said is very different from what he did. You know, people run around going, I'm a fan of Reaganomics. I believe we should cut spending and cut taxes. Well, Reagan increased spending, and he increased taxes on working people 18 times. He cut taxes massively on the top 1%. It didn't work out so well for the country over the long term. But over the short term, if you want to get the economy back on track, put people to work. It's really simple. Put people to work. We've done it before, and it's worked. People say, well, you know, Franklin Roosevelt didn't get us out of the Great Depression with a New Deal. Actually, we went from 25% unemployment to 13% unemployment in the first 4 years of his administration. That's pretty damn good. And then, he got reelected in 36. And so in 37, his first year of his second term, he said, well, okay, you know, the Republicans are all going hysterical. We'll dial back on the spending a little bit. They did, and poof, we had another recession. Unemployment jumped back up again to like 15, 16%. But then came World War II. By that time, unemployment was back down around 12, 13%, which is still way too high. And World War II took unemployment functionally to zero. People say, well, World War II got us out of the Great Depression. Well, World War II was the biggest government spending program of the 20th century. And we did it mostly with borrowed money. Borrow and spend. Put your economy back together, then those people have money in their pocket, and that creates demand in the private economy. Taking the public sector, the government sector, using that money to put people to work, those people, even though they're working for the government, even though they're drawing a paycheck from the government, they're spending the money in the private sector because we have both in this country. They're not buying things made by the government. They're buying things made by private industry, which means the private industry needs to hire more people to make those things. And as they start hiring more people, they start hiring them away from the government. And so the need for government employment goes down as the actuality of private sector employment goes up. This is pretty simple stuff. Now, there's one group that gets this, that figured it out. And that's the Progressive Caucus in the House of Representatives. And they laid out a budget. They call it the Balancing Act, which is a great title. It's getting no press at all. But the Progressive Caucus put forward a budget in the House of Representatives. Raul Grijalva, Keith Ellison, Jan Schakowsky, really, really good people, put together this budget that would solve the problem of the sequester, that would get largely rid of our national deficit, begin paying down the debt. The act achieves a one-to-one ratio of cuts to revenue. It would close tax loopholes that encourage companies. This is from a statement by the Center for Policy Studies. The Balancing Act would close tax loopholes that encourage companies to ship jobs overseas. It would close loopholes that pay billions of dollars annually to the highly profitable fossil fuel industry. It would close loopholes that allow tax breaks for yachts and corporate jets. It would also limit deductions for the wealthiest taxpayers, close loopholes for hedge fund managers, and close estate tax loopholes. In addition, it eliminates $278 billion in wasteful Pentagon spending and invests those savings in our number one economic priority, job creation. Okay, pretty straightforward stuff. So Business Insider, it's a website and a magazine. Business Insider did a poll of registered voters. And they didn't tell them, here's the Republican idea, which is cut spending. Here's the Democratic idea, which is raise taxes and cut spending somewhat, but mostly raise taxes. Actually, it's 50-50. And here's the Progressive Caucus idea. They didn't say that. Instead, they gave the details of the three plans. And here's the results. There's a nice piece about this by the staff of Common Dreams over at commondreams.org. John Quigley put it together. The poll found that in addition to beating the House Republican plan and the Senate Democrats plan overall, more than half of the respondents supported the Balancing Act compared to sequestration, and only a fifth of the respondents were opposed. In fact, 47% of Republicans liked the House Progressive plan, as long as they weren't told it came from progressive Democrats. Excuse me. So here we, this. And by the way, when people didn't know which plan was which, 57% of people opposed the Republican plan. Like I said, it ain't rocket science. Unfortunately, it has become tribalism. Democrats don't want to, you know, they hate what Republicans say simply because Republicans said it. Republicans hate what Democrats say simply because the Democrats said it. And nobody wants to hear what the progressives said because, after all, that's the far left fringe. Except that when you ask average Americans, what do you like, and you don't put the labels on it, they will always go with what the progressives want. But you're not going to hear that in the media, which is corporate-owned and corporate-controlled. And you're certainly not going to hear it on right-wing talk radio, which is just, you know, going hysterical.
Oh, Bob Woodward is threatened by the White House, you know.
Nah, not so much. It's like Bob Woodward punked him. Even Eric Erickson is coming out going, I've been punked. That's funny. Russ in Williston, North Dakota, says you disagree with me, Russ, so you're at the front of the line. What's up?
I guess to your audience, I say we can't spend money. We can't put in the economy money we don't have. And
we have the money. We have the money, Russ.
Well, here, I'll finish my thought. You were saying, you know, if we cut spending, we lay people off.
Right.
And that's true. That's true. But those are tax dollars that now, for example, stay in my pocket.
No, they don't.
Now, I can spend and
no, they
go
don't.
Back into the economy.
No, they don't, Russ. They're not going to stay in your pocket.
Well,
we're still
in
deficit.
$10,000 in federal taxes this year. So that's money I don't.
Russ, if those people get laid off, you're not going to get a penny. Your taxes are not going to go down one penny. This is to reduce the deficit, not to reduce Russ's taxes. The Republicans are not proposing to cut your taxes. They're proposing to reduce the deficit, and I'm saying the deficit is not a problem. And they want to reduce the deficit in this insane way that Europe has been doing it. Of saying, let's fire a bunch of government workers and let's cut benefits to people. So, and what's going to happen is those workers and those people will not have money to spend with private companies. It's not going to affect your taxes at all.
Where do those people get their money to spend? It's from taxes. Where does the government get its money?
It prints it. We are the sovereign issuer of our currency, unlike Greece and unlike Spain. We issue our own currency, so we print our money.
Okay, so it's either taxes or inflation, either way.
No, you don't. Inflation is not the consequence of printing money. If it was, when the Fed created $29 trillion in 2008 during the Bush administration to deal with the banking crisis, there would have been massive inflation. There was no inflation. In fact, we actually had deflation. Printing money doesn't cause inflation. You can't give me an example of any time it has. What causes inflation,
I guess,
whether it's what, and we could
I,
use...
I could.
Well, try. Give me one.
Well, I mean... You know, this is one of those things where it's going to be, and you're obviously more educated on it. And in my recall of things I have, you know, little bits I have heard is not, you know, great.
But you've been told stories, Russ, that aren't true.
Well, you know, it's like this economist you just had on. Everything is smoke and mirrors, it seems, because now he's saying there is no Social Security fund. You're telling him there is.
Right. He's saying it's, yeah, but the Social Security has invested their money in treasury bills. And he's saying that's just an IOU. And I'm saying, hey, you know, that's the IOU that George W. Bush was born with $1 million worth in his trust fund. I'll take it. Russ, I got to go. Thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I will, however, after the break, explain how inflation comes about, and it's not by printing money, even though everybody thinks it is. We'll be right back. Welcome back. So I promised I would talk about inflation. The inflations that most people are familiar with are the inflation during the Carter years, and it's usually attributed to Jimmy Carter, although it arguably started during Jerry Ford's administration and continued into the Reagan administration. So there's that inflation. When Louise and I actually bought a house, and I think we paid 13% on the mortgage. I mean, interest rates were really high. And this was the Fed trying to wring inflation out of the economy. And I would argue that the Fed did not wring inflation out of the economy. The Fed had very little to do with that. That inflation was caused by, during the Nixon, the tail end of the Nixon administration, as I recall. Well, actually, there was another one, you know, toward the end of the Carter administration with the Shah. But basically, it was the Arab oil embargo at the end of the Nixon administration, where the countries of the Middle East, who were, you know, our primary suppliers of oil, after, you know, we supported Israel in the war and what, you know, when Israel acquired the Gaza Strip. You know, these countries basically said, that's it, no more oil for you guys. And we had long lines at the gas stations. Louise and I lived in Detroit at the time, so it must have been 72. And 71 or 72, maybe 73. But I'm pretty sure it wasn't. I'm pretty sure it was 72. These long lines at the gas pumps and you know, people having fist fights and stuff, and you had to wait 6 hours to get gas, and you could only buy, you know, even or odd days depending on your license plate, last digit of your license plate number and all this kind of stuff. The price of oil, first Nixon tried to suppress the price of oil by putting price controls in place. That didn't work. That just, you know, that created basically a black market. Price controls never work. Then Nixon, pardon me, it's my day to sneeze. Then Nixon put into place this odd-even system, and that didn't work because then people started hoarding. And so basically what happened finally, you know, he stopped trying, and what happened, the price of oil went up. I mean, it went up substantially. Late 60s, you could buy gasoline for 25 cents a gallon. By the 70s, it was up to 60, 70 cents a gallon. I mean, the price of oil went up. That still sounds incredibly cheap now, but A, keep in mind back then, you know, the minimum wage was like, you know, $1.50, $2 an hour, something like that. And a dollar would buy a lot more than it buys now. And B, that was a rapid rise in price in a short period of time. Now, why would just a rise in the price of oil cause inflation, cause all these consequences? Because oil is a primary commodity. There are a couple of primary commodities that if they go up in price, because everything else is based on them, you can't have a functioning country without them. When they go up in price, then pretty much everything goes up in price because everything's related to their price. You know, we ship things by oil, we make things by oil, we make our electricity by oil. Back then we made a lot of it, we don't so much now. We power our entire transportation system, 90% of our transportation system with oil. We make oil into plastics, we make oil into chemicals, we make oil into drugs. So the price of oil went up, inflation happened. It's real simple. Now, that's spiked inflation. It had nothing to do with running the printing presses. We were not running the printing presses. Similarly, you say, well, you know, okay, you just said that the minimum wage in the 70s was a buck, I think it was $1.65, $2, something like that. And now it's, you know, $7.25, it should be $10. But, you know, doesn't that mean the dollar has been deflated in value? Yes. And governments deflate their currencies at a fixed rate over time. And they do it for a very specific reason. They do it so that they could borrow, you know, with today's currencies at today's rates and spend at today's rates and then pay back at a cheaper rate, pay back with less valuable currency. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why you have, for people who are not in the investing market, you have cost of living increases for people on Social Security and things like that. And it's one of the reasons why people who do invest try to invest in ways that'll beat inflation. You're not going to get around that. Governments are always going to do that. But that's inflation that is not considered real, oh, my God, it's a problem inflation. That's just, you know, every government does this. This is what central banks control. Right now it's running a little over 1%. And you could argue it's running 2 or 3% depending on the basket of goods that you're looking at. But in terms of the value of the dollar, when you compare our dollar to other currencies, it's 1%. The other one everybody points to is Zimbabwe. Look at Zimbabwe. You know, back 15, 20 years ago, they literally went from, you know, one, whatever the currency was, I'm forgetting, I think it was based on the old British currency, but whatever it was, Zimbabwean dollar, let's call it. It took 10,000 to buy one. There was a 10,000 to one in inflation. People think that's because Robert Mugabe ran the printing presses. Not so. It's because what he did was he said Zimbabwe used to be Rhodesia, and it used to be run by, you know, by whites who had basically taken all the land from blacks, and they ran these farms, and they'd run them for several generations, and the farms ran quite efficiently, not fairly, but efficiently. And Mugabe came in and said, okay, that's it. You know, we're going to take the land away from the whites, and we're going to give it to local Africans and local Zimbabweans and let them run the farms. And had he given it to local Zimbabweans who actually knew how to run farms, probably everything would have been fine. But instead, he gave it to his political buddies. He gave it to his cronies. He gave it to people who were members of his political party who knew nothing about farming. And so the productivity, the ability of that country to produce food collapsed. I mean, it dropped down, it dropped by 60, 70, 80% over the period of a couple of years. And the result was that food was in demand, supply was down, and so people started bidding up the price of food. Food is a primary commodity, and so you had inflation, massive inflation, because people have to eat. That's what causes inflation. Inflation is always driven by increases in the price of commodities. If you're a sovereign nation like we are and you produce your own currency, you can regulate that day-to-day inflation. And we do, and we historically always have. And you cannot insulate yourself against price shock inflation, things like oil, unless you generate all your own electricity, which we should be doing, frankly. But that's how it works, just so you know.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
6 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. And Mike Papantonio on the line with us, the attorney and host of Ring of Fire Radio, now ringoffireradio.com, the website, and now also Ring of Fire TV, Sundays at noon Eastern Time on Free Speech TV. And, Pap, welcome back to the program.
Tom, how are you, my friend?
I am great, but I'll get better. I hope the same is true of you.
Good, yeah.
Indeed. Okay, so my question. Isn't it time for Antonin Scalia to put down the black robe and just start wearing his white hood to court?
Well, you know, the unfortunate thing is what we've done is we've made some of these we've taken the Supreme Court and we've created this myth around the Supreme Court. When I was in law school, as a matter of fact, you know, semester after semester, I'd have a constitutional law professor talking to me about the idea that Supreme Court decisions are not based on politics or ideology. They're based on stare decisis. They're based on precedent. They're based on prior cases that they review and then follow a rule of law. Nothing is clearer or should be clear to the American public that that's a lie. That simply is not true. And this five-member majority of the very conservative majority of the Supreme Court has proven that to be very true. Listen, this is a judge. Now, can you imagine? I read everything that comes out of there because I have to. It's how I make a living. But can you imagine a Supreme Court judge saying that we have to do away with the Voter Act because all it does is perpetuates entitlements for the races? I mean, you know, and if you really consider how outrageous that is, you then start understanding this man is not a jurist. He's a politico. He's a hack. He's a political hack, always has been his entire career, but he's a political hack with a robe on. So we look at him, we say, oh, we have to hold him up in some kind of greater honor. It's a shame that we haven't seen that earlier.
Well, at least FDR was willing to call the Supreme Court out on their politics. And,
sure.
And you know, eventually when he threatened to use Article 3, Section 2 to change the composition of the court to say any justice over 70 years old, all of them in aggregate end up with one vote, and they're called Justice Emeritus. And then we get to add new members to make up for those that are missing, which was called packing the court. And frankly, I just read a book on this about a year ago. From a historian, you know, that was written in the 60s, 50s, and 60s, who had lived through the time and been part of the process. And he was of the opinion that had FDR actually pushed that, he probably could have won that case. But what happened was the court in 37 just started changing their decisions and going along with them, even though the composition of the court hadn't changed. Tell me that's not political?
Well, of course, and he was going to change the numbers, increase the numbers.
Yeah.
They saw it was coming. But FDR had the courage to do that, Tom.
Yeah.
And, you know, the unfortunate thing here with Obama, he's a constitutional law professor. And as a constitutional law professor, he's kidding himself. I don't know if you caught this, but it was an outrage. I still am scratching my head saying, really? But a couple of weeks ago, he's in front of a crowd, Obama is, and he says, you know what, it's okay if they do away with the Voters' Rights Act, because we're going to be able to solve the problem. You're still going to be able to vote. Well, I didn't hear the end of that sentence, because there is no solution, Tom.
Hmm.
If you take Section 5 out of that act, and the Department of Justice has no teeth, understand, think of the irony of this. Alabama is up arguing this right now. 240 times they've had to have the Voter Rights Act come, Section 5, they've had to enforce that against Alabama for Alabama's intent to purge voters, come up with ID scams that were completely bogus, to redistrict, you name it, Alabama's tried everything. Right. 240 times, Section 5 has saved that state, saved the people in that state, and given them the right to vote. And here we have a president that says, you know, we're going to be okay even if we don't have that. It's
well, this
la
is
la
this
land.
this is the logic that is being argued before the Supreme Court,
right,
is that Section 2 gives people who live in Alabama standing to sue if they feel like they've been discriminated against. But if Section 5 says that the state has to pre-clear any changes in law, so if only Section 2 survives, then all the Republicans have to do when they want to suppress the black vote or the Latino vote or any other vote in particular, you know, young people, old people, you name it, they've figured out a way to suppress it selectively. All they have to do is put that into law about a month before the election.
Sure.
And there will not be time to litigate that case. The election's held. They get the result they want. And then whether they win or lose, if they lose and the law gets wiped out, that's fine with them. They just wait until a month before the next election and introduce the law all over again.
Tom, you know what's so ugly about this is we're out there, and you have – this is the best example I can give you of the fact that this isn't naivety. These judges know this majority, this conservative majority, Kennedy, Scalia, Alito, Roberts, Thomas, they know exactly what they're doing. And and for them to even have to even suggest us and dress up like they're trying to find some real logical, rational reason for doing away with it is absurd. They know that in 2006, the 20 days of hearing, thousands of documents were reviewed by Congress and the Senate, and the Senate unanimously voted to say, we have to have this.
Right.
As a matter of fact, you had Sessions and you had Shelby, you know, not exactly two great bastions of liberal thinking, in Alabama, who voted to say we need to extend this Voter Rights Act.
Right, 2006.
2006, excuse
yeah.
me. And so the point being, this is all a facade, and until we can be honest enough with ourselves to where we can say, look, we know who they are. The media, the traditional media trying to understand by way of some involved political analysis is laughable.
Mm-hmm.
And so it comes down to sheer politics. You have a Scalia that making statement after statement, and you do wonder, where's his white sheet?
Yeah.
And of course, you've got his handmaiden, Clarence Thomas, sitting there, who's never asked an intelligent question since he's taken to the court.
Yeah. And whose wife is at least for many years, was, you know, living off the Heritage Foundation. I don't know if you and I have ever discussed this, Pap. I'm actually working on a book on judicial review. Nowhere in the Constitution does it say that the Supreme Court has the right to strike down laws passed by Congress. Thomas Jefferson went insane when Marbury versus Madison was decided in 1803. He said, by this decision, the Constitution has become a thing of wax to be molded in the hands of the judiciary. The only two times, I mean, the court is the final court of appeals. It's pretty explicit in Article 3. And literally from the founding of this republic up until roughly the Civil War, for the first 80 years of the existence of the court, only twice did they decide on the constitutionality of anything. The first time was in 1803 in Marbury, and that created such a firestorm. I almost use an obscenity there. Such a firestorm that they didn't do it again until 1856 in Dred Scott, and that worked out really well.
Yeah.
and it's like I don't, you know, but they did. I mean, literally the court was like deciding whose dog killed whose chicken. They were literally the court of last appeals. They were an appeals court, the final appeals court. And now all they do is decide constitutionality, and I'm of the opinion that what this has done is it has turned America from a constitutionally limited representative democratic republic into a constitutional monarchy, and the monarchs are these nine people in black robes at the Supreme Court.
For life. Well, look, let's take, that was an excellent point, and it's just right on point with anybody that's analyzing this problem. But if you really think about it, the only issue that this court should be talking about is this act constitutional? It's already been held constitutional. It's already been written in so many different ways, on so many different levels. It's all, you know, the Congress has stated, they've renewed it time after time. The only question is it constitutional? Now, the arguments have been proposed, of course, and throughout the years in one form or fashion, is that it lacks equal protection, it lacks due process, but that's been tested, and it's been decided.
Yeah, and the 15th Amendment says, second sentence, Congress shall have the power to pass legislation to enact this.
Like, that's right.
How could it end? That's part of the Constitution. Mike Papantonio, ringoffireradio.com. Check it out. Pap, great having you with us as always.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you. We'll be right back. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Ring of Fire Radio. And speaking of the Supreme Court, so one of our callers today is going to get a copy of my book, Unequal Protection, which discusses this issue, sent out by Stamps.com. Hey, it's Thursday. It's the day that I get 3 minutes of geeky science. One of my favorite topics is science, and this is so cool. Monkeys invented the margarita. Well, maybe. According to a new study, our love for wine, beer, and all things alcohol may be an ancient craving that our ancestors had, too. Our ability to metabolize ethanol, that's ethyl alcohol, the stuff that's in beer, wine, and spirits, may have originated in a common ancestor of gorillas, chimps, and humans around 10 million years ago, around the time when that ancestor may have become more prone to eating fruits that were fermenting on the ground. These new insights into our alcoholic ways were discovered by Stephen Benner, a chemist at the Foundation for Applied Molecular Evolution in Gainesville, Florida. Benner reached these new conclusions by resurrecting the alcohol-metabolizing enzymes of extinct primates. Benner and a team of researchers estimated the enzyme's genetic code, built the enzymes in a lab, and then analyzed how they worked in order to understand how they may have changed over time. Humans today rely on an enzyme called alcohol dehydrogenase 4, or ADH4, to break down ethanol that we drink. ADH4 is found in the esophagus, the stomach, the intestines. It's the first alcohol-metabolizing enzyme that comes into contact with booze when you drink. And to understand how ADH4 enzyme had evolved, Brenner and his team read the DNA sequences that make up ADH4 in 27 modern primate species, including lemurs, monkeys, apes, and humans. Next, they mapped out the DNA sequences on a primate family tree and guessed what the genes may have looked like a long time ago at points on that tree where primates' evolutionary branches separated. These branching points represent our extinct primate ancestors. The results showed that most primate ancestors would not have been able to metabolize ethanol. It would have been poison. But at the branching point leading to gorillas, chimps, and humans, which represents a common ancestor that lived around 10 million years ago, the ADH4 enzyme became a powerful digester of alcohol. In fact, compared to earlier enzymes, the ADH4 enzyme was nearly 50 times more efficient at digesting alcohol and almost capable of breaking down the level of ethanol found in today's alcoholic drinks. Benner believes that the enzyme evolved thanks to certain species of primates spending more and more time on the ground. It's like us when we came out of the trees and started running around in the fields, where we would come across fallen fruits that were fermenting. In order to consume these fruits safely, the primates were forced to develop a digestive enzyme that could break down the ethanol. This may also explain why primate species that typically spend more time above the ground in the trees, like orangutans, are unable to successfully digest and metabolize ethanol. So the next time you head to the bar and wake up with one heck of a nasty hangover the next day, just remember you may very well have a monkey or a gorilla to thank for that, or at least a common ancestor. And that's our geeky science for the week. Patricia in Sacramento, California. Hey, Patricia, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Hey, Tom, I want to comment quickly on labor, and then I just want to add a quick note on banking, which is another industry we need to talk about. But I agree with what you're saying. We need to use the money, you take the government and spend and create jobs, but we need to make sure we're creating good-paying jobs. I mean,
yes.
If Obama sits there and says, well, I created this many jobs this month, and these are Walmart service jobs, to me, that doesn't mean much. We do need to function again by having manufacturing. We need to revamp the government by not allowing corporations to go in and get the politicians to change laws, labor laws,
right,
that do not.
Which means changing our labor. We need to bring back card check. We need to change our trade policies, and we need to raise the minimum wage to at least $10 an hour.
Absolutely. All there. Now, just quickly touch on banking here. The one thing I was disappointed with Obama is that I didn't see him rein in the banks, and I didn't see Democrats in addition to doing this, because my fear, Tom, is that I think that the banks are still in a dangerous place. I think they're hiding what is actually in their books as far as how much risk they're taking, and the reason is because they know that taxpayers are going to continually bail them out. There was an article on CBS News the other day talking about this, that the banks are still, you know, not where they need to be.
Oh, Elizabeth Warren was talking with Ben Bernanke about this 2 days ago.
Yeah, and I don't know if, I think Ben Bernanke may see the risks in this. But
he's afraid to unwind them. He's afraid to unwind them because he doesn't want to be the guy who causes the next crash. And frankly, they're going to be unwound. There is going to be a crash because the structural problem has not been addressed. And, you know, everybody's celebrating. The Dow passed 14,000 today. If I owned stock in the big banks, I would be selling it right now. And if I wanted to speculate in the stock market, I would be buying some of the bear funds like VXX, which I mentioned when I had that street sense
guy.
Yeah,
and one more thing, Tom. I think the one thing that a lot of maybe your listeners may have forgotten, do you remember when Bank of America transferred, I believe it was $50 trillion of their derivatives into being secured under FDIC?
I don't remember, but I took your word for it.
These were risky investments that were not secured by any means. Now they're under FDIC.
Right.
I don't know. You may know better than I do, but I haven't seen Obama or the Democrats try to change that.
Yep.
And once again, my fear is you've got $400 trillion between London and the U.S. in derivatives.
Yep.
If something goes wrong and these derivatives go bust, how are we going to secure depositors' money? I mean, we really need to look at
this. The cap on that, Patricia, is that the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the FDIC, only insures the first, it used to be $100,000, then it went to $150,000, it bumped up to $250,000 for a while. I think it's back down to $150,000. I could be wrong. I know that was a short-term increase. But whatever it is, let's say it's $250,000. It only insures that first $250,000. So it basically protects, you know, most working class and middle class people have $250,000 or less in the bank. And so if the banks, and this is why I'm a fan of the banks failing, because if the banks fail, you know, it's going to take down are the fat cats, the high rollers. Although
I think that's frankly
why Mitt Romney's putting his money in Swiss bank accounts.
To community banking.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're absolutely right. We do need to be moving to community banking and to credit unions, you know, where you can actually be a stockholder in the bank. Every dollar that you invest represents a piece of that. It's not called a bank. It's called a credit union of that institution. So, Patricia, thank you for the call. Excellent point. Yes, there has been very little done about this. It does concern me. It concerns a lot of people. And we'll see how it all plays out. 27 minutes past that.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
One of our callers today is going to receive a free signed copy of my book, Unequal Protection, sent out by Stamps.com. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, you know, boy, the market is within 50 points, I think, of its all-time high. It just hit 14,000. I don't see that as a good thing. Because the fundamentals of the economy are not solid. I see that as, frankly, another bubble. And, you know, I don't offer investment advice on this program. In fact, I am a lousy investor. Over the years, a couple times I did okay. It's a couple times I really made stupid decisions. So by and large, I don't. I don't have that much money anyway. It's not like, we're sitting on zillions or something like that, or even millions. But it's like, I just don't do it. But if I did, I would be running from this market personally. I just, when the conventional wisdom says, hey, it's time to jump in, that's when I think it's time to get out. But who knows? Nick in Cliffside Park, New Jersey. Hey, Nick, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thank you for opening up again with what you opened the show with a couple of hours ago. I think that there's a pattern that when the stock market goes up, the poor are getting poorer, the middle class is getting shrunken, working class losing jobs, general quality of life goes down, and yet for the 1%, things get better. And I think that that pattern runs across the board. Just about anything good that you can think of, people having better health care, better education, better housing, anything good that more people voting, registering to vote, anything good you can think of disturbs the status quo, which upsets the people at the top. So we have all manner of extremely perverse, malevolent incentives for interests to keep things as chaotic and as disorderly as possible. And in the short run, they can make killings. And as you just said, at the top, they can dictate the market, make the market, and then when the greedy folks get in there and try to get in on this big growth, then they pull the bubble, they burst the bubble. Yeah. Then they buy what's left over cheap again, and we go, off to the races all over again.
That's right. And that's what the really serious investors. Well, first of all, you've got the billionaire brokers on Wall Street who make money regardless of how the market works, because they're just taking a piece off the top of everybody else's trading. Or they're doing machine trading. But secondly, the really smart investors are, what they do is they sell when the market's high. When the middle class, there's this apocryphal story. I first heard it from Gloria Swanson back years ago. When she was still alive, she was on the board of directors of the Children's Village that Louise and I started. And I would go to New York a couple times a year and we'd have dinner in her apartment. She'd been a vegetarian since the 20s. And she told me the story about how Joe Kennedy told her that when the market went up, he knew that when shoeshine boys and taxi drivers started giving him tax tips, that's when he knew it was time to get out of the market. And that's why he was not hurt by the crash of 29. And I've since heard that story from other people. I think it's probably apocryphal. But I've heard it attributed to other people as well. But the fact of the matter is that the professional investors, when they see the middle class moving into the stock market en masse, that's when they start moving out. And, it's the middle class that always gets screwed. It's the unsophisticated investors.
But again, I want to apply that to the larger context of anything. I'm going to get back to that point. Anything that's good, more people registering to vote, more people voting, more people having health care.
We used to have other metrics, Nick. I was listening to Harry Truman's 1948 acceptance speech this morning. We're going to play a clip from it in the next hour. And I listened to most of the speech today. And we used to use the metrics of what is the average wage in America. And if that went up, then we thought our economy was doing well. We used to use the metric of how many people are working at a good living wage. We used to use the metric of how many people have union jobs. Presidents actually used to, read the 1956 Republican platform, the platform that Dwight Eisenhower ran for re-election on. He bragged about the fact that over 1 million additional people had become members of unions. Those used to be the metrics that we used, the things that, more people bought homes, more people were able to go to school on the GI Bill, in other words, for free. Those are the metrics we used to use, and we used to have labor sections in our newspapers. Now the metric we use is the stock market, and you're absolutely right. The stock market indicates the health of Mitt Romney's class, and when it crashes, they know how to, avoid getting burned. In fact, they know how to profit from it.
It's totally perverse, and we take it for granted that I understand it, you understand it, your audience understands it, but unfortunately, the bulk of the American people apparently still don't get that.
No, they don't. And everybody likes to jump in on the parade. Everybody, the hysteria starts, look at that. And all the networks are, oh boy, the market passed 14,000. It's time to get in the market. And people take their 401ks, they put them in the market. And I'm like, no, it's the time. Now is the time. But, again, I don't do it investment advice because back in 2007, and people who've been listening to this program for years know this, back in 2007, the Kansas City Fed, I think it was, pointed out that it was, as I recall, it was the second quarter of 2007. I might be wrong. It might have even been the end of 2006. But it was right around that time. This was before 2008. Housing starts in the United States dropped over 30%. And I came on this program because I'm writing a book about this stuff right now. I've been looking into what happened back in the 30s. And I came on this program and I said, in 1927, the housing bubble burst. Housing starts dropped more than 30%. And that led directly to the stock market crash in 1929. So I would get out of the stock market if I was in it right now. And I said that in 2007. And for another year and a half, the stock market continued to climb. It went up another couple thousand points. And I was getting all this email from people going, you idiot. And, you know, look at all the money I'm making and like that. And I'm like, I'm just not going to play in this market. I, you know, when housing starts are going down, you know, in other words, when the fundamentals, when the stuff that drives an economy are starting to collapse, the stuff at the top is going to fall. And sure enough, it did in 2008. And now we just got this report that the last quarter was flat. You know, housing is supposed to be going up. Look at the cover of Business Week, you know, but basically it's another one of their race. They're being criticized for it being a racist cover because they've got, you know, a couple of women and a man of color and, you know, a bunch of people in a house with money flowing out of it, talking about the second housing boom and how good did the last one work out. In other words, look out, there's a bust coming. And but they didn't show a white guy or a bankster or anything like that. And you know, they were implying that basically people were back into liar loans. But there's actually some truth to the fact that the housing market is being hyped right now. And I just think that we're being set up for the crash of 2015. I'm you know, or before. So, Nick, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. Jeff in Portland. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, Tom, longtime fan and listener. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask you two questions. Both start out with commondreams.org post. The first one, you spoke of Joe Quealy. He did a great earlier in the week. He posted something called "Collusion with Austerity Will Sink Obama," mm-hmm. and I think it's something worth checking out. And my question would be, you know, you're talking with Mike Pamtonio, who's awesome, about using the bully pulpit. Why hasn't the president used the bully pulpit to explain and educate people, as you were doing, about the difference between, and most people don't understand this, the difference between a family budget or a city or state budget compared to the federal budget, the big difference being that the Fed can print money. I mean, that's a huge thing that people don't understand.
Well, that's one difference. Here's another one, Jeff, that's a really important one that's far easier. If you want to just use the frame that the Republicans and the people, the debt deficit hawks, the debt hysterics are using, where they say, oh, look at this, we're in debt. You know, our GDP is $15 trillion and our debt is now $15 trillion. We owe more than we make every year. Okay, you say to them, do you own a house? And they say, well, yeah, I own a house. What's it worth? Well, and I'm just making up numbers here. What's it worth? Well, it's a $300,000 house. And so you have how much of a mortgage? About $280,000 mortgage on it. And you earn how much? Oh, I make $50,000 a year. So your debt is six times your income? And you are hysterical that our government is one-to-one? That's the discussion that I would have with most of these people, although most of them don't want to come on the radio and talk about what their mortgage is. But you get my point.
Right. Yeah, and that's why the biggest number isn't the deficit number itself. It's the deficit to GDP ratio. Exactly.
But it's not even really that. It's we need measurements of the genuine productive economy, and we don't have them. And the point about being in debt to own your house, there's a general consensus that if you're in debt to own a house, that's a good thing because a house is an appreciating asset. Over time, it becomes worth more. On the other hand, if you're in debt because you ran up $100,000 on six credit cards in Las Vegas, you know, there's a general consensus that that's a bad thing. Or if you're in debt because you just went out to eat at fancy restaurants every night for the last 2 years, that's a bad thing. So there's good debt and there's bad debt. And if the United States, you know, to take that household analogy, if the United States was to say, okay, we're going to run up another $1 trillion in debt, and we're going to use that debt, we're going to use that money to hire people to rebuild our roads and our bridges, to build schools, to build a high-speed broadband network all across the United States so that just like in South Korea, everyone's got a T1 line coming into their house. That's what we're going to use it for. That's an investment. That's like borrowing money for your house. And the Republicans want to characterize all government spending as if it was borrowing money, putting money on the credit card to go to Las Vegas, or putting money on the credit card to go to a fancy restaurant. And it's not. There's good spending and there's bad spending. Jeff, I got to run, but thank you for the call, and thanks for, you know, opening the topic and giving me an opportunity to rant about it as well. We will be right back, 45 minutes past the hour. Unequal Protection is the book we're giving away today.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And don't forget, our program is brought to you in part by the efforts to free America's political prisoner, Governor Don Siegelman. Go to free-don.com. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Ellen Ratner of the Talk Radio News Service is with us, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. You can give a goat to help a rescued slave and receive a photo of your goat and the person you helped at goatsfortheoldgoat.com. And odds are Ellen Ratner will be in that picture because she goes to Sudan periodically.
Well, I'll take the picture. I'm going in 10 days.
Wow. Cool. Okay. So
we always welcome you back, Tom.
Good luck and Godspeed on that trip. I'm going to have to hop on the plane with you one of these times.
We should get
Joe to go again, you know. In fact, I saw him last night. That would be a hoot, Joe.
That
sure
would be a hoot. We'd have a great time.
Yeah.
Okay. Lots going on. Let's see. Let's talk about sequestration.
Okay.
Since that seems to be the hour of the day. The Senate rejected two bills. This was going to try and get $85 billion in automatic spending cuts to go bye-bye. The Democratic bill won by 51 votes. Clearly not the 60 votes necessary to get a real vote on the floor. The Republican only got 38 votes. That means a lot of Republicans didn't even vote for the Republican one.
Hmm.
So that's kind of interesting. And so it looks like that just
so
went,
there's just nothing happening. Then.
There's nothing happening on that one. But what's really interesting about that, and this is a National Journal report, that is not a talk radio news report, but they quote Alice Rivlin. She was the former budget director. Mm-hmm. She co-authored, and she deals with this bipartisan policy center. She said, what most people forget is how much we've cut spending already.
Right.
They act as if we've just raised taxes. We've cut discretionary spending a lot. She also said non-defense discretionary spending is on track to fall to record lows in the next few years as a result of budget deals in 2010.
Well, and in fact, from 2008 when Obama was elected, or 2009 when he took office, until today, nationwide, there have been somewhere between 600,000 and 800,000 government employees gone, fired, toast. I mean, government has contracted radically. And what's the result? Unemployment's still high.
Exactly. I mean, look, I was just reading a biography of Eisenhower.
Yeah.
Well, what about all those highways of ours? Well, yeah. That wasn't a government jobs program. I'll eat this microphone.
Plus, he put into place a program where 50% of the cost of every new hospital that was built in the United States in the 1950s and early 1960s was paid for by the federal government.
Wow. Good old Eisenhower. Bradley Manning has pled guilty. He said he did not aid the enemy, which would have been a death penalty. He's up for 20 years. He pled guilty to 10 charges. And, of course, a lot of us think that he was actually tortured by absolute lack of human contact, et cetera, while he was there. The House passed the Democratic version of the Violence Against Women Act. This is another fascinating issue. 60 Republicans joined every Democratic House person saying no to the Republican bill.
Wow. Now, the Republican bill basically said we're not going to extend the Violence Against Women Act's protections to gay women, to Native American women.
Illegal immigrants.
Women who are illegal immigrants. And I don't understand why the Republicans felt that those three groups were not worthy of protection.
What they said is it doesn't mean it isn't for gay men and lesbians or Native Americans. But you know as well as I know, particularly with Americans for Disabilities Act or any other, if you don't spell it out in the law, it doesn't happen.
It doesn't get enforced, yeah.
And, right.
and the thing on the Native American reservations was particularly troubling because what was happening was non-Indians were going onto the reservations, raping women, and then leaving the reservation. And there was no jurisdiction by which these rapists could get caught. And it had virtually become a sport near some of these reservations.
That's right.
And
now the whole issue, should tribal courts be allowed to prosecute these people. Right. Of course they should.
Right. So.
All right. The United States. Senator Kerry was in Rome today. No, not for the Pope leaving office, although that was dominating the news.
That would be entertaining. Pope goes out. Kerry comes in.
Right. Okay. Exactly. Well, he announced Thursday that today, I'm reading our own news, that they're going to provide Syrian rebels with $60 million and also provide them with non-lethal aid supplies for the first time. So I don't know what that actually means, but probably everything except bullets and guns.
Right.
That may be uniforms. It may be anything.
Could be a lot of eye in the sky stuff, too.
There was a Friends of Syria conference that he was involved in.
Interesting.
Okay.
So we're taking a serious position on this.
Has
there been any blowback? Has Russia, for example, come back and said, oh, wait a minute, or...
Well, this was just today, I don't know. I mean, it's late at night
in the Middle East. Yeah.
So we don't know. Okay, the IRS said they're not going to furlough any of these employees until after the tax filing season. However, they're giving furloughs of 4 to 5 days, but they're not going to do that till after that. And there is a government union that represents 150,000 federal workers. They're very concerned about that. And the IRS said basically if they do not deal with this very quickly, they're going to have to, there'll be delays in refunds. So they cannot furlough people under the sequestration plan.
Hmm.
I mean, that's just another.
They should keep them long enough to take the income and the filings, and then on April 16th say, now we've got to delay the refunds, and then people...
Right. Yeah. Okay. Anyway. One last very important thing. Today, the federal court did get the United States' friend of the court briefing on ending the California gay marriage ban. Their court, in their wisdom, has done it over the 2 days of Passover, if you can believe it, is when they're hearing these two cases. So they're hearing the Proposition 8 case first, and then they're hearing...
there are several Jewish members on the court. Is that...
It's shocking to me. I mean, of course, Passover celebrated at night. How they pick the 25th and 26th, or 26th and 27th. Anyhow, yeah. It's the first day of Passover, which doesn't begin till sundown. Okay, we'll grant you that. And then they're doing it the next day as well.
Right. And I think it's worth emphasizing, today was the last day that the White House could file a friend of the court brief on behalf of gay marriage, basically.
That's right.
And they did.
And
there was
a lot
of speculation about whether they would or not.
Well,
this is a pretty
when Jay Carney was asked
step.
About it today in the briefing, Carney basically said, I refer you to the Justice Department. I mean,
right. But they did it.
They did it today.
Okay. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Always great having you with us. And go check out goatsfortheoldgoat.com to see what we're talking about. We'll be right back. 57 minutes past.
Listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program, Business Insider Magazine. Recently polled a group of registered voters. I referred to this earlier in the show, but I really want to drill into this right now. The magazine was asking people for their preferences on three different congressional plans that have been floated to help the nation avoid damage from the looming sequester. And what the poll found was that when voters didn't know which plan was whose, the policies that most voters preferred were those offered up by the Progressive Caucus in the House of Representatives. More than half of the people who were polled favored the Balancing Act plan, which is proposed by the Congressional Progressive Caucus. And shockingly, 47% of Republicans polled preferred the House's progressive approach, or at least the House Progressive Caucus's progressive approach, instead of the across-the-board cuts being proposed by the Republican congressional leaders. According to Business Insider, the results show that not only is America not a centrist country, like is commonly believed, not a center-right country, but that the policy ideas most attractive to American voters are those that are most often put on the back burner getting little attention and virtually no publicity from the corporate media. Or to put it simply, very few Americans like the ideas and policies proposals coming out of the Republican Party and from a few of the conservative Dems. It's clear that Americans know which ideas will actually help the country and disagree with the bizarre Republican position that only those things that help the billionaire class in corporate America are going to help working people. You know, they say that history repeats itself. And it seems to me like this is an example of it. Consider the state of American politics in 1948, when Harry Truman, who had been president for, 3 years, I believe, at that point in time, he was the vice president when FDR died, and he became president in 40, my recollection is 45, 46. Had to be, yeah. In any case, in 45. And here in 1948, he's accepting the Democratic nomination for president of the United States. Here's what Harry Truman said in his famous acceptance speech, speaking about the reason why Americans prefer Democratic ideas over bizarre Republican beliefs.
The people know that the Democratic Party is the people's party, and the Republican Party is the party of special interest, and it always has been and always will be.
There you go. Truman went on to list the accomplishments of the Democratic Party at that time. He highlighted increased investments in the agriculture industry, increases in wages and salary. Remember, I said earlier, we used to have different metrics than just the stock market. Increases in wages and salaries and massive increases in the GDP. Speaking about these boosts in the American economy, Truman told the crowd at the convention in Philadelphia this.
These benefits have been spread to all the people because it's the business of the Democratic Party to see that the people get a fair share of these things.
Yeah, after highlighting how the Democratic Party had helped Americans and worked wonders to improve the country as a whole, Truman then proceeded to list how Republicans had failed the country in the 80th Congress, that he'd been doing battle with, by the way, for the past 2 years, and how Republicans always ignored the well-being of average working people. He said this.
Ever since its inception, that party has been under the control of special privilege, and they concretely proved it in the 80th Congress. They proved it by the things they did to the people and not for them. They proved it by the things they failed to do.
Those things included refusing to act on, and Truman went through the list in his speech, refusing to act on a housing bill, refusing to enact moderate legislation to promote labor-management harmony, tearing apart the Department of Labor. Republicans in the 80th Congress refused to even pass an increase in the minimum wage. They refused to fund more public education in schools. They refused to pass any sort of comprehensive health program. And more importantly, they refused to fix the tax code, but instead passed more tax breaks on for the very rich. Speaking of the Republican refusal to fix the tax code, here's what Truman had to say.
Now, everybody would like to have low taxes. But we must reduce the national debt in times of prosperity. And when tax relief can be given, it ought to go to those who need it most and not go to those who need it least, as this Republican rich man's tax bill did when they passed it over my veto on the third try.
From failing to fund our public schools to trying to tear apart labor, keeping the wallets of the wealthy elite padded. You know, I mean, just look at this. Truman's 80th Congress and President Obama's 113th Congress, same thing. And in 1948, in the election of 1948, after Truman gave that speech, the American people realized how little the Republican Party had done for the country and how much that party cared about the interests of the wealthiest Americans. And Truman ended up winning the presidential election in 48. Because he told the truth about the Republican Party. But perhaps even more importantly, the Democrats took back the House of Representatives. They took back Congress. Because Truman spoke so bluntly, the Democrats' win in the House of Representatives was so overwhelming and so long-lasting that Republicans did not take back the House for over 40 years. As Truman closed his acceptance speech, he spoke of the 80th Congress and the Republican inaction.
Now, what that worst 80th Congress does in this special session will be the test. The American people will not decide by listening to mere words or by reading a mere platform. They'll decide on the record. The record as it has been written. And in the record is the stark truth that the battle lines in 1948 are the same as they were back in 1932 when the nation lay prostrate and helpless as a result of Republican misrule and inaction.
And, you know, like I said, history repeats itself. The battle lines are drawn pretty much the same as they were in 48 and in 32. Millions of Americans are struggling to survive, to get a proper education. The very rich are making out like bandits, all thanks to Republican, what Harry Truman called, misrule and inaction. You're going to see it start tomorrow with the sequester. If the Democrats of today would speak more and more like Harry Truman did, we could get this country back on track. You need to get out there and share the word with others. There was a piece in that speech where Harry Truman just went through the list of things that the Republicans refused to do. It runs about 2 minutes long. And, you know, I'm going to have to dig that out and play it for you. I thought it was so cool. I mean, Harry Truman just nailed it. He just absolutely nailed it. And he says, I called for an increase in the minimum wage. The Republicans did nothing. I called for help for housing. The Republicans did nothing. I called for, he just goes through the list. And the same thing is happening right now. And as Ellen Ratner just reported, you know, the sequester is going to stand. The layoffs are going to begin tomorrow. The economy is going to go in the tank, and all these Republicans who have been telling us for years now, oh, if you just cut government spending, then the private sector will prosper and everything will be wonderful because government will be out of the way. And everybody in America is going to see that the Republicans have been lying to them for 32 years. We're all going to get to see it. Even Republicans are now acknowledging Republicans have been lying because they're saying, oh, you know, it's Obama's sequester. The damage is going to come from Obama. Well, hey, wait a minute. If Reaganomics is right, if cutting government leads to prosperity, then the sequester should give us prosperity, shouldn't it? We'll see. And I think all Americans are going to know. This is a very interesting time. Keep a close eye on what's going on. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And one of our callers today is going to receive a free signed copy of my book, Unequal Protection. You know, the one about Citizens United, sent to you by Stamps.com. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. I was reading through the civil rights cases. No, not those civil rights cases. The ones that were argued before the United States Supreme Court in 1883. In 1883, oops, wrong mouse. In 1883, there were a series of cases brought before the U.S. Supreme Court. And those cases included U.S. versus Michael Ryan, Richard A. Robinson and wife versus the Memphis and Charleston Railroad Company. And apparently there was another one that's not named in the final decision. And while Justice Harlan wrote a dissent in which he said these were civil rights laws that were passed after the Civil War to guarantee that people had the right to participate in commerce and the right to vote. They were extensions of the 14th and 15th Amendments. The 13th Amendment freed the slaves. The 14th Amendment gave equal protection to people regardless of race. And the 14th Amendment and the 15th Amendment said that regardless of race, color, or previous position of servitude, you may vote. And Congress has the right to pass laws to enforce these. Congress did pass laws to enforce them. They were called the Civil Rights Act laws of the 1860s and 1870s, and they were struck down by the Supreme Court in 1883. This is where Scalia is getting his logic from. I just have to share this with you. This is from the majority opinion. This is the winning opinion in the case. And it was written by Justice Bradley. This is, by the way, the same court, essentially. The makeup of the court is very, very similar to the court that decided Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad in 1886, just 3 years later. That where they supposedly decided that corporations are people. So here we are at the end of this decision. And they write, when a man has emerged from slavery and by the aid of beneficent legislation has shaken off the inseparable concomitants of that state of slavery, there must be some stage in the progress of his elevation when he takes the rank of a mere citizen and ceases to be the special favorite of the laws. You getting this? In other words, there has to become a time when, you know, former slaves were saying, you're not a slave anymore, so you don't deserve any protection. Okay, let me continue. And when his rights as a citizen or a man are to be protected in the ordinary modes by which other men's rights are protected. There were thousands of free colored people in this country before the abolition of slavery enjoying all the essential rights of life, liberty, and property, the same as white citizens. Yet no one at that time thought it was any invasion of his personal status as a free man because he was not admitted to all the privileges enjoyed by white citizens or because he was subjected to discriminations in the enjoyments of accommodations in inns, public conveyances, and places of amusement. In other words, before the end of the Civil War, let me just tell you what he just said. This is the winning decision of the Supreme Court in the civil rights cases of 1883. That before the Civil War, there were freed blacks in the northern states, African Americans in the northern states who were free. And even though they couldn't sleep in the same inn as a white person or eat in the same restaurant as a white person, they did not complain. This is what the Supreme Court was saying. Mere discrimination on account of race or color were not regarded as badges of slavery. If since that time, the enjoyment of equal rights in all these respects has become established by constitutional enactment, it is not by force of the 13th Amendment, which merely abolishes slavery, but by force of the 13th and the 15th Amendments. On the whole, we are of the opinion that the countenance of authority for the passage of the laws in question can be found in either the 13th or 14th Amendments of the Constitution, and no other ground of authority for its passage being suggested. In other words, they're saying, the Constitution's already dealt with this. You don't need additional laws. Okay, this is what they're fixing to say. You don't need civil rights laws because the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments are there. Let me start over again with this paragraph. On the whole, we are of the opinion that no countenance of authority for the passage of the law in question, that's the civil rights laws, can be found in either the 13th or 14th Amendment of the Constitution, and no other ground of authority for its passage being suggested, it must necessarily be declared void. This is the Civil Rights Act. It must necessarily be declared void, at least so far as its operation in the several states is concerned. They struck him down. And the very last paragraph, this conclusion disposes of the cases now under consideration. The cases of the United States versus Michael Ryan, Richardson versus and Robertson, A. Robertson and wife versus the Memphis and Charleston Railroad Company, the judgments must be affirmed. In the other cases, the answer to be given will be that the first and second sections of the Act of Congress of March 1st, 1875, this is the Civil Rights Act of 1875, entitled An Act to Protect All Citizens in Their Civil and Legal Rights, are unconstitutional and void, and the judgment should be rendered upon the several indictments in these cases and quarterly. Accordingly, it is so ordered. So that was how the Supreme Court struck down in 1883 the Civil Rights Act of 1875 by saying, hey, time has to come. Let me just read that again, because this is exactly what Scalia was saying yesterday. There must be some stage in the progress of his elevation, his being the former slaves, when he takes the rank of a mere citizen and ceases to be the special favorite of the laws, and when his rights as a citizen or a man are to be protected by, in the ordinary modes by which other men's rights are protected. In other words, special protection? You don't need special protection. The ordinary law will work just fine for you. Yeah, that worked out really well for like 100 years after this decision. This was 1883.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And this is what 1883 is what Antonin Scalia wants to take us back to. You just watch. Good, the bad, and the very, very hesternopathically ugly, the good. Dennis Rodman, the former NBA star known for his off-court antics and colorful hair, is in North Korea, and he might actually be improving U.S. relations with the reclusive nation. According to reports, he's getting along very well with North Korea's new leader, Kim Jong-un. After attending basketball games together in Pyongyang, Rodman told Un, "You have a friend for life." So maybe we can expect some high-profile one-on-one basketball games between the two, or maybe a golf match. But seriously, with North Korea conducting nuclear tests and relations between our government and theirs very tense, Dennis Rodman is the most high-profile American to meet face-to-face with Kim Jong-un, and apparently they really hit it off. So who knows? Maybe Dennis Rodman, the man who was once the bad boy of basketball, the man who once wore a wedding gown to promote his book, and who once dabbled in professional wrestling, that Dennis Rodman might be America's next top diplomat. The bad. State Senator Jim Rice, the Republican from Idaho, is so outraged about proposed gun control laws that he wants to strengthen the state militia to take on the federal government. He's proposing a constitutional amendment that would make all Idaho adults eligible to be drafted into the state militia. As he said, his amendment will, quote, allow the state to backstop the individual right to keep and bear arms in an effective way that is supported by the reasoning in all of the U.S. Supreme Court decisions, end quote. So, State Representative Rice is willing to take up arms against our government if they pass any gun control laws. After all, that worked out real well for Jefferson Davis and that, you know, the whole country back in the 1860s. And the very, very ugly Congressman Louis, I talk about necrophilia in the House floor, Gohmert. In a recent interview with the right-wingers at Newsmax, Gohmert made a comparison between slavery and government spending. He said, quote, slavery and abortion are the two most horrendous things this country has done, but when you think about the immorality of wild, lavish spending on our generation and forcing future generations to do without essentials just so we can live lavishly now, it's pretty immoral, end quote. Right. Let me make the distinction for you, Congressman. Slavery was a moral crisis that eventually tore our nation apart in war. Our national debt, however, is something that the billionaire class wants us to think is a moral crisis just so they can dismantle government, pollute all they want, pay their workers slave wages, and make billions more in profits. Got the difference? Congressman Louis Gohmert is behaving in a way that is very, very ugly. Okay. I went off on Harry Truman. I tracked that. I just want to play a couple minutes of Harry Truman for you because step into the Wayback Machine with me and what was his name and Mr. Peabody and Sherman and Mr. Peabody and listen to Harry Truman in 1948 speaking at the Democratic National Convention. This is President Harry Truman. Let me see if I've, tell me if this volume, works.
It was said when old Pierre died, the prices would adjust themselves for the benefit of the country. They have adjusted themselves all right. They've gone all the way off the chart in adjusting themselves at the expense of the consumer and for the benefit of the people that hold the goods.
He's talking about things he's trying to get through Congress.
I called a special session of Congress in November 1947. November the 17th, 1947. And I set out a 10-point program for the welfare and benefit of this country, among other things, stand by price control. I got nothing. Congress has still done nothing. Way back 4.5 years ago, while I was in the Senate, we passed a housing bill in the Senate known as the Wagner-Ellender-Taft bill. It was a bill to clear the slums in the big cities and to help erect low-rent housing. That bill, as I say, passed the Senate 4 years ago. It died in the House. That bill was reintroduced in the 80th Congress as the Taft-Ellender-Wagner bill. Name was slightly changed. But it was practically the same bill, and it passed the Senate. It was allowed to die in the House of Representatives. The Banking and Currency Committee sat on that bill. It was finally forced out of the committee. Then the Rules Committee took charge, and it's still in the Rules Committee.
Deja vu all over again.
But desperate pleas from Philadelphia in that convention that met here 3 weeks ago couldn't get that housing bill passed. They passed a bill they called a housing bill, which isn't worth the paper it's written on.
That's what Republicans do. That's what Republicans do. They pass things. They say, oh, well, we'll solve the problem. Sure, we'll fix Medicare. Here's Harry Truman.
In the field of labor, we needed moderate legislation to promote labor management harmony. But Congress instead passed that so-called Taft-Hartley Act, which has disrupted labor management relations and will cause strife and bitterness for years to come if it's not repealed. And the Democratic platform says it ought to be repealed.
Now, Taft-Hartley is what is used by now Michigan to create the right to work for less states. That's Taft-Hartley.
I tried to strengthen the Labor Department. The Republican platform of 1944 said if they were in power, they'd build up a strong Labor Department. You know what they've done to the Labor Department? They've simply torn it up.
Just like today.
There's only one bureau left that's functioning, and they cut the appropriation on that, so it can't hardly function.
Just like today.
I recommended an increase in the minimum wage.
Just like today.
What'd they get? Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
It's 1948. He's talking about the Republicans.
I suggested that the schools in this country are crowded, teachers underpaid, that there are a shortage of teachers. One of the greatest national needs, more and better schools. I urge the Congress to provide $300 million to aid the states in meeting the present educational crisis. Congress did nothing about it. Time and again, I have recommended improvements in Social Security law, including extending protection to those not now covered.
Listen.
Increase the amounts of the benefits. Reduce the eligibility age of women from 65 to 60 years.
To 60.
Congress studied the matter for 2 years but couldn't find time to extend the increased benefits. But it did find time to take Social Security and benefits away from 750,000 people. And they passed that over my veto.
That's what Republicans do if they get their hands on Social Security, is they take it away
from
people.
I've repeatedly asked the Congress to pass a health program. The nation suffers from lack of medical care. That situation can be remedied anytime the Congress wants to act upon it. Everybody knows that I recommended to the Congress a civil rights program. I did so because I believe it to be my duty under the Constitution. Some of the members of my own party disagree with me violently on this matter, but they stand up and do it openly. People can tell where they stand, but the Republicans all profess to be for these measures. But the 80th Congress didn't fail to act. They had enough men there to do it, and they could have had cloture. They didn't have to have a filibuster. There were enough people in that Congress that would vote for cloture. Now, everybody would like to have low taxes. But we must reduce the national debt in times of prosperity.
They were in prosperity.
And when tax relief can be given, it ought to go to those who need it most and not go to those who need it least, as this Republican rich man's tax bill did when they passed it over my veto on the third try.
So there you go. There's a lot more in there, but I, you know, we just burned through 6 minutes of the show here. Harry Truman was an amazing guy, an amazing politician, and with that speech, he won the White House. But not only did he win the White House, he took the House of Representatives, and the Republicans didn't get it back for 40 years. It wasn't until the Bill Clinton administration and Newt Gingrich was able to engineer, you know, his little contract on America, his 10-point plan, six of which pointed back to a piece of legislation that simply dropped taxes on rich people. Amazing. Amazing. Well, anyhow, James in Belvidere, Illinois, you wanted to talk about employer last resort?
Yeah,
James?
I think I tried to talk to you before. Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, Tom? Yeah. Why don't we develop a program? I mean, you got to think outside the box on this, but it can't be co-opted by politicians, the banks, or business. And that's making a program that uses our capital through our tax structure as making us the employer of last resort.
We did that, James. We did that in the 1930s. It was called the WPA and the CCC. There were several other programs in aggregate. It was called the New Deal, and it worked quite well. And then we did it with World War II. It was called the Army. Go ahead.
Yeah, the solution, though, is public and private. So you got public things. We all need public. We're all public and private. You use public things, but then we have private lives, too. Now, the chicken or the egg, which creates the taxes for the public?
It's real simple when you think about it, James. Just consider this. If somebody's got a government make-work job, they've been hired by the government to dig a hole, and the guy who lives next door to them has been hired by the government to fill that hole. Okay? So it's just a make-work job. They're paid by the government. When they take that money, that paycheck, where do they spend it?
Man.
In the private sector, right?
Back to China.
They're not buying things from China. They're buying things from local stores. I mean, ultimately, it might go back to China, which takes us into a discussion of our trade policy. But it goes back into the private sector almost immediately.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Everybody knows exactly where I'm going with this. It's like, China, it's our trade policy. Yes, of course it's our trade policy. Welcome back, Dwayne, in Petaluma, California. Hey, Dwayne, you wanted to talk about inflation?
Oh, yes. First of all, you're doing great. I love it when you talk about Truman and when the 1% decided we'd won World War II, we may as well declare war on the working people. I was talking about inflation. Your presentation suggested that the Arabs basically decided to up the price that we were going to pay for oil.
No, they didn't up the price. They reduced the availability.
And my recollection was that Kissinger made a suggestion to the Shah that if he was having trouble financing his army, he should simply increase his price of oil, and that they orchestrated that Kissinger's favorite bank. And it's my recollection that the president of Kissinger's favorite bank spent some time visiting with Nixon on two occasions on the day of the oil embargo.
Wouldn't surprise me. You know, Dwayne, it wouldn't surprise me at all. But the bottom line is because there was an Arab oil embargo, it drove down supply, which drove up demand. And when demand goes up, prices go up. I mean,
I'm objecting to the use of the word Arab because Shah and the Iraqis are not Arabs.
Ah, okay.
It was orchestrated by...
So it was the Persian oil embargo.
Yeah.
Okay. Dwayne, I'll give you that. Shano says you get the book. Hang on just a second. You're going to get an autographed copy of Unequal Protection and compliments of stamps.com. Dwayne is online, too. You can let Danielle know. Okay. Ralph in Rochester, New York. Hey, Ralph, what's up?
Tom, your show is truly Viagra for the brain. I can't even tell you how percolated I feel after I listen, even just a little bit. I always try to find when there's a problem, I always try to find the root of the problem.
Mm.
And, you know, this root cause of difference between Republican and Democratic ideas when it comes to everything, economy, social issues, foreign policy, it seems like the difference is the Republicans always come from the point of view of fear.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to have enough. Things are going to cost too much. We're going to get attacked. We're going to do something to scare God. Right. We're going to, I mean, there's just
the deficit is a burden on your grandchildren. Yeah, got it.
Yeah, and it's just this enormous amount of fear. And it's so funny because years ago I read Seven Habits of Highly Effective People by Stephen Covey.
Who's a Republican, and by the way.
Well, you know what? The book has been great. It's helped me in my life.
Yeah, it's a good book. It's a good book.
I was going to say, I'm not trying to stump for the book, but I'm just mentioning that one of the things they mention is what they call the abundance mentality versus the scarcity mentality.
Yeah.
And, you know, the people who go around with the idea of the scarcity mentality, that there's not enough pie to go around, if there's pie on your plate, that means it's going to be missing from my plate. Those are the people that are the least effective. The ones who are the most effective are the ones who say, you know what? Not only is there enough pie to go around, but we can make more pie, and there's so much pie we could never eat it all.
Yeah.
And when you're running scared, you make bad decisions. And I think that, you know, that's why, you know, us folks on the left, if I may, have a tendency to look at the folks on the right and say, geez, how are the things that we see that are so clear?
Mm-hmm.
How are you so blind to them? And, you know, and all they do is they hang out, listen to news sources or opinion sources that reinforce their fear because they don't want to feel alone.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think that to a certain extent, both on the left and the right, the role that opinion media plays, whether it's television or radio or internet or whatever, is A, to reassure people that they're not crazy, that somebody else thinks the way they do, and B, provide them with the ammunition to win the water cooler wars. You know, here's what you need. And those are things that I actually try and do on this program, and certainly they try to do on the right. The problem is, that I think that we have as a country, is that those of us on the so-called left, if you look at the positions that we're taking, they're the positions, A, that the majority of Americans agree with, right on down the list, and B, they're the positions that historically have worked, that have historically helped this country out, and the positions that the people on the right are taking are historically the positions that have devastated this country, whether it was Herbert Hoover in 1920, or not Herbert Hoover, it was Harding. Warren Harding running for president in 1920 on the platform of more business in government, less government in business, Herbert Hoover saying when the crash happened in 29, we're just going to do nothing and we're just going to, you know, it'll eventually right itself. And it didn't. It just got worse and worse and worse. And you know, I just think, you know, we're right and they're wrong. Now, I realize they would say the same thing, but I think that the facts bear out our side of it. Ralph, thanks a lot for the call. Excellent point. Jay in Oswego, Illinois. Hey, Jay, what's up?
Hey, how's it going, my friend? Hey, you know what? Agree along a lot of lines. Probably going to not dispute what you're saying, but add another layer of logic here.
Okay.
Here's what I hear, and this is going to take us to a one-party dimension. And I already know that you'll probably decry that, and you won't like where I'm going to go. But what does our system work? I guess that's the question, because, you know, if history repeats itself, doesn't that mean that both sides of the system breed that? And if the Democrats, if only they would, kind of makes me feel like, well, if only, but they're paid to not, if only, and they're all golfing and they're teeing off together. And it's a beautiful symbiotic divide and conquer, you know.
You know, if there was no Progressive Caucus, the Democratic Party, I would agree with you. But there is. And in fact, the Progressive Caucus is the largest caucus in the Democratic Party, or maybe the second largest, but I believe it's the largest. And they have proposed a budget, and last year, Jan Schakowsky was on this program talking about it. Raul Grijalva was on this program talking about their balancing act.
But look at the timing, Tom. In other words, of course, it's when the Republicans have the power in Congress.
So no, it doesn't matter. The progressives have always been around, and the progressives are growing. The number of progressives in the Democratic caucus has been growing. And you know, I see that as a good sign, and that's why I think that if we want to have a functioning democracy, we need more progressives in political office. And Jay, I wish you'd run for something. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to WCPT. We'll be back tomorrow, Friday. And of course, that means Brunch with Bernie, America's Senator. Senator Bernie Sanders is going to be here talking about the issues of the week and taking your calls in our national town hall meeting. And anything goes on Town Hall Friday, your chance to choose a topic and tell me what's on your mind. Plus, tomorrow is the first day of the sequester. That should be entertaining. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It starts with you. Go to free-don.com or pdamerica.org. or movetoamend.org. Tag your it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.